Hi, this is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I want to welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. I hope that wherever this finds you, you are doing well today. And we're going to begin moving into Jesus' actual peace teaching this week. We're going to start with Matthew 5, 39 through 43. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. I tell you, love your enemies. This is another place in this series where I want to emphasize that Jesus did not teach his followers here to be passive or to be pacifists in the sense of do nothing, P-A-S-S-I-V-E, pacifists, but rather passivists, which is P-A-C-I-F-I-S-T-S. And you can check back to part one of this series for a more detailed explanation of the difference between these two. One is reaching for a peaceful outcome. The other is a sit back and do nothing. What we're going to see is something quite remarkable in this week's podcast. We'll be looking at more of Jesus' teaching on the way of peace in the coming weeks, but this week I thought we'd begin with this passage right here, which is actually the most famous peace teaching of Jesus found in the Sermon on the Mount if you're reading it from Matthew, or the Sermon on the Plain if you're reading it from Luke. Jesus here shows that the goals of his kingdom, they cannot be accomplished by violence. But the rejection of violence, however, it shouldn't be interpreted as passivity again. Far from counseling passivity, Jesus' statements here about turning the other cheek and giving the cloak, going the second mile, as we're looking at in this passage, what they actually teach is an assertive and even confrontational nonviolence that provides an opponent with an opportunity for transformation. With these suggestions that Jesus is giving, the oppressed person actually has the potential to seize the initiative and to shame the offender or to strip him of his power to dehumanize. Jesus said, "If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also." I want you to try to imagine this. Picture this in your head. The only natural way for a blow to land on the right cheek was with the back of the hand. Such a blow would be a show of insult by a superior to an inferior. And let me try to explain what I mean by this. Normally, one would not strike an equal in this humiliating way. Doing so actually carried an exorbitant fine in that culture. But try to picture the scene once again in your head. Since the left hand was only used for unclean tasks, and if you've ever been a third world country, you understand what I'm talking about. Hitting the right cheek with the left hand would not have occurred. Yet hitting with a closed fist would have involved hitting someone on their left cheek. This would produce another problem. A blow from a closed right fist would be acknowledging that the person you're striking is an equal. But again, this would have had to have landed on their left cheek. If it's going to land on their right cheek, there's something else being implied here. A superior would, like a master over a slave, in this culture, a husband over a wife, although I don't believe that, and I'm glad we live in the 21st century, not the first century. A parent over a child, a Roman over a Jew, a man over a woman, once again in this culture, a superior would specifically not want to strike an inferior with the fist. To be showing yourself to be superior, showing them to be inferior, you would want to strike them on the right cheek, but in order to do this with your right hand, it would have to be a backhanded blow. The backhanded blow to the right cheek had the specific purpose in this culture of humiliation, and a blow in retaliation would have invited retribution. This turning the other or the left cheek shows that the supposed inferior is refusing to be humiliated. And with the left cheek now bared, he's telling the striker, sure, hit me, but hit me as an equal. You're left with giving the striker here two options, either a left-handed blow, which would have been unclean, or to blow with your right fist, which would have agreed that they were equals. But neither of these options would be acceptable to the supposed superior, so he lost the power in this instance to dehumanize the other. Now notice in the next example Jesus gives, what we're seeing here is that Jesus not only taught the theory of nonviolence, but he's actually giving us real examples here of how to apply this theory. And again, this doesn't even begin to look at how then he modeled this theory throughout his entire life and ultimately his death as well. But once again, let's look at this next example. This one is best understood in a court of law. The court of law is the setting for Jesus' injunction about giving the cloak or the undergarment along with the outer coat. The law allowed a creditor in this culture to take the coat or outer garment as a promise of future payment from a poor person without the means to pay a debt. You can find this in Exodus 22, 25 through 27, Deuteronomy 24, 10 through 13, and verse 17. And I really want to encourage you to actually do take the put in the effort and go back and look up those verses. Only the poorest person would have only an article of clothing to surrender as security. And since the coat was likely the debtor's sole remaining article of clothing, the wealthy had to return it each evening for the owner to sleep in. Further, in that society, the shame of nakedness, you have to remember, it fell on those viewing the nakedness or causing the nakedness, more on the naked person. You remember this from the story of Noah's son Ham, when Ham looked on the nakedness of his father. Yeah, the person being naked wasn't as shamed as the person who took advantage of this moment to look on that nakedness. And remember, most people only had two articles of clothing, and they didn't wear underwear in those days. So thus, stripping off the undergarment in public, in a public setting like court, along with the required outer garment, would have the effect of turning the tables on the wealthy creditor. It would have put the poor person in charge of the moment while exposing the exploitative system and actually shaming the wealthy and powerful person who's taking the last object of value from this very poor person. So you have to think of it, and as awkward as it is, yes, Jesus actually here is endorsing public nudity. This is a radical act of protest, but it's a nonviolent protest. Whether we like it or not, Jesus here is recommending streaking with a cause as a viable option rather than returning violence with more violence. Now, let's go to the third example, going the second mile. This had a great power to actually embarrass the soldier who compelled the first mile. The Roman law allowed soldiers to command at will the forced labor of carrying burdens for 1 mile. But this labor was limited. There was a limit to this service, and that was limited to 1 mile, that the soldier could only compel 1 mile out of the person he coerced into carrying this baggage. So the limitation provided some protection for the occupied people, like the Jews. But if one followed Jesus' words and cheerfully carried a burden beyond the required first mile, it put the soldier in a very awkward position of not complying with the limits imposed by his superiors. As a result, the soldier could end up in an embarrassing situation or an embarrassing position of actually begging the civilian to put down the burden, lest the soldier be disciplined. And you have to imagine the follower of Jesus saying something like, no, I'll cover this for you. If you get in trouble, I'll vouch for you that I've volunteered. And then you have to imagine what kind of discussion would have taken place between the soldier and this Jewish person during the second mile. And you have to remember, this was a Roman soldier, someone deeply despised by the Jewish people. Try to get your head around what Jesus is actually telling them to do here. Jesus' follower for that entire second mile would have been able to demonstrate what Jesus' kingdom was really all about. In these cases, Jesus' instructions are not, once again, commands of passive non-resistance. The phrase, "resist not an evildoer," could be problematic if Jesus did not then demonstrate immediately following in these three stories, trying to express and illustrate exactly what he meant. The actual Greek word here for resist is anthistomai. It indicates a resistance by returning violence for violence, overcoming evil with evil rather than overcoming evil with good. And Thistamai is a violent resistance, much like how the nation of America, let's say, would resist, or rather exercise violent resistance toward anyone who tried to breach her borders and take over her territory. In the days of the American Revolution, a common symbol of this type of resistance, this enthistami resistance, was illustrated with a flag, a yellow flag, with a coiled-up rattlesnake in the center of this flag, with the words above it, "Don't tread on me." The rattlesnake was a fitting illustration for these Americans rebelling against British abuse. Basically, what they were saying is, step on us, and we will strike. The rattlesnake snake would never strike of its own accord, but it would defend unto the death. But this is the point. Never should this symbol represent the kingdom Jesus came to establish. Never should enthistami, never should violent resistance be taken to illustrate what the kingdom is. Never should it be taken to represent the Father, and never should it represent those who claim to follow Jesus. The imagery of the snake is used in the Bible, but it's not used to represent God. The serpent is someone else. You can see Genesis 3:15 for this. Jesus chose rather to represent the kingdom and his Father and all those who would follow him with the mascot of a lamb, a baby sheep. But let's be honest here. Was Jesus teaching that in rejecting violent responses that we should then simply do nothing? I think from the three examples Jesus gives us, we get a clear absolutely not. Jesus was teaching nonviolent ways for oppressed people to take the initiative, to still affirm their humanity, to expose and neutralize exploitative circumstances. Jesus is demonstrating nonviolent ways in which people at the bottom of society or under the thumb of even imperial power, these ways that they can learn to recover their humanity while at the same time reach out and redeem and restore even the ones who are the oppressors in the situation, who are actually victims too, just like them, of this greater systematic evil of their culture. Now, as we close, there is one note of balance that I do want to make sure we mention here and we make clear. It is also possible to use these resistance strategies in ways that humiliate and belittle our oppressors. This is why Jesus was careful to immediately follow these teachings up with the injunction, love your enemies. The importance of this, again, I don't believe can be overemphasized. These strategies provide an opportunity to reverse a situation in ways that are aimed at preserving the humanity of all who are involved, victim and oppressor alike, and to keep open the possibility of restored relationships. Violent responses only close the possibilities of redemption and reconciliation. And this is not what Christ's kingdom was to be about. This is why the goals of the kingdom Jesus came to establish cannot be accomplished by violence. Through the means that Jesus teaches here, however, you have to remember that followers of Jesus can witness to the truths of the kingdom as a contrast to whatever social order that does not recognize the rule of Jesus. In practicing these nonviolent strategies, these peaceful or pacifistic means of confrontation, the followers of Jesus can do many things. They can witness to a new way of living, a new way of doing life in Jesus' kingdom. It also opens up, once again, or leaves open, at least, the possibility of redemption or reconciliation of the opposers or the violators or the victimizers. It not only protects the humanity of the victim, but it leaves open the possibility of redeeming even those who are doing the victimization. And lastly, in those possibilities that are being left open, you're extending an opportunity at the same time for even the person who's oppressing you to repent, to change the direction they're moving in, and to become a follower of Jesus too. Basically, when you follow these non-violent means of confrontation, you're giving the gospel cry, "The kingdom has come." And you're giving your oppressors the opportunity to join you. Again, this was the way the followers of Jesus understood what it meant to follow Jesus for the first 300 years of Christianity. We'll be looking at much more of Jesus' own peace teaching over the next few weeks. And yes, we'll get to all those questions you guys have been emailing in too. But for this week, remember, Jesus here is not teaching you just to roll over and take it. He's teaching us how to actually exercise a third option. Not a violent response and not a do-nothing response, but a response that rises above the violation and actually seeks to even redeem our violators as well. So this week, once again, keep living in love, keep loving like Jesus, and go out there and keep building the kingdom. I love you guys. We'll see you next week.